Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me every week as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Welcome. Today I'm delighted to have Jay Sivapalan from Janus Henderson join us. Good morning, Jay. How are you today?
Morning, Liz, and thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Now, very excited to have Jay here because he is lead portfolio manager on the Janus Henderson Tactical Income Trust, as well as heading fixed income in Australia. And you would have seen we would have published Janus Henderson's monthly income reports, which I think are just outstanding. So really delighted to have you here, Jay, and hoping we can really delve into the Tactical Income Trust. Perhaps we might start, though, with markets and your thoughts on direction of interest rates and inflation.
Yeah, sure, Liz. So there's so much to really talk about and consider when we're thinking about markets as it pertains to interest rates, inflation, and then, of course, credit spreads and a whole range of other associated areas. But perhaps, you know, if we start from where are we today, you know, we're, approaching 18 months on from the onset of the pandemic, working through the vaccine rollout. Of course, now we've got some brief lockdowns occurring throughout Australia. And indeed, other parts of the world starting to climb out of lockdowns. But then also consider this period in the context of what's been happening in the last decade and beyond. So I think, you know, the recovery from the pandemic, that's pretty clear cut, and that is occurring all around the world. We are starting to see a strong recovery, strong reflation, a few bumps along the way. So what would policymakers do in that sort of scenario and setting? Of course, they want to, and they are eager to normalize policy. Now, policy has been twofold, monetary policy and fiscal policy, but let's just touch on monetary policy for the moment. But their eagerness stops there. And the reason it stops there is because they are also considering what else they're facing from a broader macroeconomic perspective. And that is, to deal with the pandemic, they've had to borrow or facilitate governments and households and corporates to borrow an enormous amount of money. So fast forward 5 to 10 years, the biggest problem we're going to have that we're going to have to solve is financial stability. The more debt you have, the more vulnerable economies are. And you know, one of the lessons of the pre-pandemic period, in particular between the GFC and COVID-19, that decade long, is that we just didn't generate enough growth and therefore enough inflation. And so the risk is that you end up becoming more like a Japan type of environment well after the pandemic. So I think policymakers have that, you know, firmly in their mindset, those risks against the high levels of debt. And so there are only really one or two ways that you can climb out of that situation. And that is to be able to grow your way out of debt and ultimately inflate your way out of debt. So policymakers, whether it's central banks or governments, are focused on this. And so what we're likely to see is that both arms of policy are going to be used for quite some time to continue to support the private sector, which is quite different to that period before COVID-19, where, if you recall, monetary policy was doing all the work. But fiscal policy was certainly, you know, we were trying to get our budget back to surplus, and lots of countries in Europe in particular were going through austerity and so forth. So that's one of the big themes that we see. And so I guess in that environment, policymakers are effectively in the long run trying to manufacture some level of inflation. Now, near term, there is, and I think there's evidence is starting to be quite clear now, there is some transient inflation today. And that may persist for 12 to 18 months before it settles down. But I guess our focus has been more on the more longer term objective of policy. Now, whether they're going to be successful or not is yet to be seen.
So you're seeing inflation as transitory in the near term, and you're not thinking it's here to stay. Are you then thinking we are more like a low rate environment for a very long time, low inflation environment? I guess if you could just expand on that, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So I guess, you know, a range of near-term factors. You know, we know we saw the supply side disruptions in the supply chains. We know that our borders, for example, in Australia are closed. Therefore, that's keeping, you know, some levels of inflation, in particular wages inflation, a bit higher than they would be ordinarily. So that's why we believe near-term inflation is transient. But that said, the resolve of policymakers to get inflation up is much stronger today than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. So we're certainly not of the view that we're just going to go back to a low rate, low yield and low inflation world. Perhaps the way things unfold is that central banks really try to promote inflation, which means they keep rates low for a considerable period of time, let's say 5 years. Perhaps not at current settings, but not materially higher than current settings either. And then ultimately inflation unfolds, at which time they can normalize policy. So we're talking about a 5 to 10 year program for policymakers as opposed to a 2-3 year program, albeit there will be tapering.
And when you say normalised policy, you're really talking about like a normalised interest rates, aren't you? Like that they're at a higher level in case we hit another hiccup or recession, then the central banks have scope to cut rates to try and stimulate the economy again.
That's right. So we've got, you know, cash rates effectively at the zero bound in most countries. And so normalisation in that world against a higher level of stock of debt. May perhaps being trying to get cash rates up towards 1% as an example, as an initial start. And then on the fiscal side, you know, most governments are running significant deficits today, perhaps some plan to gradually broaden the tax base through higher growth and higher tax revenue to gradually move their budgets back towards surplus. Now, that's a long time away still.
In Australia, definitely. I'm not so sure about the US. Biden seems fairly intent on implementing higher tax rates, is my understanding.
Yeah, that's right. And perhaps, you know, observing the last 10 or 20 or 30 years is not a good guide to how the next one or two decades may unfold. You know, one of the things that policymakers are really trying to manufacture is a very tight labor market. So we may end up seeing unemployment rates that we haven't seen for decades. You really need to look back to the 1950s and 60s, where in countries like Australia and in the US, where policymakers were pro-fiscal, pro-growth policies, which really brought the unemployment rate down and eventually got wages inflation and inflation going.
So that's a theory, Jay. What happens if it all falls apart and it doesn't quite happen as they want it to happen?
Yeah, I think if it doesn't arrive the way policymakers intended to, and as I said, the jury's still out as to whether they're going to be successful or not, then unfortunately, we all join the low growth, low inflation and low yield world, the likes of Japan. Now, I think there are a lot of reasons why we can be a little bit more optimistic than that. You know, fundamentally, countries like Australia, countries like US are different to the likes of Japan.
Let's talk a little bit about the tactical income fund and your strategic approach, given that background to markets and your thinking to markets. How are you allocating at the moment? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so if I just sort of break it up into a couple of different areas, so perhaps interest rate management, the second one maybe inflation, and then I'll talk about, you know, spread sectors and credit in particular. But if you think about cash rate expectations, you know, we came out of the pandemic late last year and early this year where markets weren't expecting much of central banks, to the point where they were starting to become fearful that perhaps they're throwing so much stimulus at the problem that they were going to overgrow and overheat, and then central banks will have to play catch up. So in February, you know, markets moved very quickly from lurching from, if I use Australia as an example, a cash rate profile for the rest of this decade that was barely reaching about 1.5% by the end of this decade to over 3% by the end of this decade. And so that's what caused bond yields to rise so dramatically. And then, of course, much of the last 4 months, markets have spent time retracing back to, if I look at a 10-year government bond yield now, approaching 1.2%. It peaked at 1.9%. I guess from a strategy perspective, in portfolios like the Tactical Income Fund, what we're really trying to do through what we call our fair value approach is really look through the emotions of the market and the noise of the market to come up with a reasonable understanding of where cash rates may go. And so when markets do get too carried away, we then add lots of interest rate risk or duration to portfolios like the Tactical Income Fund in a bid to lock in those higher yields for investors. And similarly, in moments like today, where bond yields are starting to fall, really reduce that interest rate risk or duration in the portfolio, not wanting to lock in bond yields. Right here, right now, we don't see the market as necessarily too expensive, but it's certainly starting to enter expensive territory, i.e. bond yields are starting to go a little bit too low. Similarly, on the inflation side, you know, the time to own inflation bonds and inflation-linked protection is when no one else wants it. So, you know, we have been a heavy user and a heavy purchaser of inflation-linked bonds last year in particular, and we had our largest allocation around April, May of last year, when inflation expectations for the next decade by the market dropped pretty close to 0%. In other words, the market assumed there's going to be no inflation for the next decade. Today, that same number is closer to 2%. And we've got a much lower holding in inflation. So given my comments earlier, we still think the longer term central banks are going to try to generate some inflation, but some of that is priced into markets. And therefore, we've got a lower holding in inflation-linked bonds.
Now, just for our listeners, it doesn't really sound like that's much of a movement, 0% inflation to 2% inflation or 1.9% for 10-year government bond rate down to 1.2%. But in actual fact, those movements, if you call them right, generate large returns, Jay.
That's right. That's right. So what we're really talking about here are the movements in the reference rates or bond yields. But in terms of the price of the securities and therefore the returns of markets, they can be much more potent because you're often implying 1.9% per annum for 10 years. So if I look at the bond market, for example, in February, that sharp lift in bond yields caused a negative 3.5% return in the bond market just in 1 month. And that was the biggest drawdown in bond markets that we've seen in Australia, monthly return, since 1983. So it is important to try to minimize those losses when bond markets are falling and then try to capture those returns when they're rising.
Fabulous. That's a really good explanation. Now, I was looking at your asset allocation of the fund, and I noticed there's quite a high allocation to cash of about 35-6% at the moment.
Yes, yeah, so physical cash in the fund is actually only about 3-4%. So the remainder of the cash is what we call synthetic cash. And where that comes from is when we think bond markets are expensive, we will typically hedge that bond market exposure, which gives rise to effectively artificial cash or synthetic cash.
Right. Okay. That's good. I'm pleased that you explained that. But also I see that you have quite a reasonable allocation to hybrids, or are you using derivatives in that market?
Yeah. So if I now talk about credit markets, given what I just mentioned earlier, it is a relatively favorable environment if you take a longer term view for companies. And that's because clearly governments are trying to encourage better employment. So the better the employment, the more the income that individuals have to spend, and that's good for corporate profits. And generally Australia and Australian companies haven't over-levered themselves, during the pandemic or even after the pandemic. So it's a good environment for corporate credit. So we want to be invested in that area. But there are going to be winners and losers. And the reason winners and losers come about is we spoke about fiscal policy, government policy. Government is not just trying to promote growth, but they're also targeting growth. And one of the big things that is changing in the world, fortunately or unfortunately, is we had a 30 to 40 year steady state in terms of world free trade agreements around the world. And clearly that's starting to be disrupted, in particular between the US and China, but we're also in the middle of that. And so thrown out of this are a few lessons also. Our reliance on China, number one, national security, number two, you know, medical technology and all the things we need to do around aged care, you know, data and privacy, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to see, you know, certain industries that are being more positively targeted by the government. So that's why we saw a month ago the government wrote out a $2 billion check for oil refinery in Australia, because we realized that we didn't have enough, you know, oil refinery capacity in Australia, which is a national security issue. We're going to see, you know, cloud computing and data storage companies benefit. We're going to see medical technology benefit, even mask manufacturing. We learned last year that we don't make enough masks in Australia. So there are going to be industries that are going to win, and similarly, there are going to be some industries that are going to be left behind. So when we talk about a favorable view to corporate debt, it's also about thinking about who the winners and losers are and investing appropriately. Now, coming more specifically to hybrids, hybrids are a relatively good instrument, but they have a time and place in defensive portfolios. So in a high-quality defensive portfolio, you can only ever invest a reasonable amount of hybrid allocations, because they are lower down in the capital structure of companies and they can be more risky. We have had a favorable view about, in particular, Australian major bank hybrids for the past couple of years. And I think if anything COVID taught us, a lot of these banks, they raised a lot of capital, held back dividends, and the losses turned out to be minuscule compared to what they'd forecasted. And so as a hybrid investor, there's a lot more margin of safety. And so that's why we like hybrids. That said, the pricing has become more expensive, and so you need to balance that. So overall, what we've been doing with our hybrid allocation is we've actually been reducing it, but still hold a reasonable amount of hybrid exposure. But the majority of the portfolio, being a defensive product, is still senior bonds and not so much hybrids.
So if we talk a little bit more about the portfolio in particular, and you've just given us that wonderful summary of the winners and losers post-COVID, are you investing in those companies that you see are winners in the bond market? Are they coming to the bond market?
Yes, in some areas they're certainly coming to the bond market. In other areas, they're still very much being serviced by the banks. So not necessarily do you get all the opportunities. But equally, there are many what we would normally call, you know, core defensive, high quality assets that have been disproportionately impacted by COVID. So think of the university sector. The university sector, because of our borders are shut, they're clearly not enjoying the foreign students and the fee income of foreign students. But not every university is created equally. If I look at University of Western Sydney as one example, they get about 70% of their students from domestic students. One of their main courses is nursing, for example, so very much domestically orientated. So it's these factors that we need to look at. And similarly, we need to look at the property portfolio. You know, what assets do they have backing? So, you know, we see an attractive opportunity there. Airports is a very obvious one. There are a whole range of other areas that have been disproportionately impacted. Perhaps their pricing is also still cheap, but worthwhile investing for investors.
Now, I think your one-year return, and I typically don't look at one-year returns, I like to look at longer returns to get an idea of funds and how managers manage them. But your one-year return for that fund is really outstanding. It's 2.2%, given that the benchmark actually lost over that same period, and that the fund is has an average credit rating of AA. I think that's absolutely outstanding and I want to congratulate you and the team. But can you talk a bit more about how you are going to look to sustain that those sorts of returns in future, given we're still in a very low rate environment?
Yeah, sure. So I guess, you know, we run a number of products that are available for investors in the public market. And they range all the way from very defensive, very high quality vanilla type cash products, all the way through to credit income orientated products. You know, a fund like the Tactical Income Fund, which is an absolute return product, really what we were really trying to achieve in the last year, when it delivered roughly about 5%, that's 2020, is to capitalize on all the dislocations and opportunities that were thrown out during COVID. And then this year, when bond yields started lifting, try to preserve capital. And that's why it delivered a positive return against its benchmark, which was negative. But it's typically a fund that's trying to generate, you know, somewhere in that order, 1.5 to 2% above prevailing risk-free assets, being either cash or government bonds. Then we've got other products like our diversified credit fund, for example, that delivered 13%+ last year. And that's trying to deliver something more like, you know, 4-ish% above prevailing cash rates. Now, of course, these returns ebb and flow, but it comes down to, as an active manager, utilizing all the different opportunities that are available in bond and corporate debt markets, and then, in a sense, taking advantage of the opportunities like we had last year, like we had in February this year, and like what we're seeing now. You know, one very quick example, New South Wales, obviously in lockdown at the moment. New South Wales state government bonds have started to underperform quite dramatically for obvious reasons. As an active manager, we look at that and say, well, that's something we can put in the portfolio because I think we're pretty confident that New South Wales government is not going to default. It may have some challenges around its revenue for a period of time. But that is something that we're able to invest in. So it's really, as an active manager, looking at opportunities in interest rate markets, so duration and yield curve, in inflation markets, in relative value, in states and semi-government bonds, and then, of course, in credit. So the example I gave you about the airports and the universities.
That's excellent, Jay. Really appreciate your time this morning. Just one last question. Do you have any very high convictions in the portfolio at the moment, or are you, as you mentioned, just trying to smooth returns and take opportunity in markets? I mean, I know you can have high convictions. Maybe the 10-year government bond rate is one of those you were saying was starting to look expensive. So just any thoughts you have that our listeners might be able to tap into?
Yeah, so if I quickly reflect on, say, last year as an example, there were a whole bunch of areas where we had high conviction. I think today those levels of high conviction are not there for the most part, but where they are there is around the policy front and the supportive policy front. So our highest conviction still remains today around spread products. So what I mean by that is by lending money to good quality companies. Because we think they're fundamentally going to be supported well. And so we would expect credit to outperform. Now, one of the things that's important for investors to understand is corporate debt in particular. You know, typically 8 out of 10 years, they do outperform, and we still see above average returns on a forward-looking basis. But it's important for investors to ride the waves. And so there will be individual months where they underperform. You know, equity markets and other risk assets, they've been on a one-way trend, reaching record highs every month. It's not unreasonable to expect that a pullback here and there. So, but in a low-rate environment, you know, it's certainly our view that it pays investors to ride a little bit of volatility to get the better returns rather than just being in cash or term deposits.
Absolutely, Jay. You've given us a lot to think about today, and we really appreciate your time, and we hope that you'll come back to talk again about the Tactical Income Fund and the Absolute Return Fund with those double-digit returns. Thank you for coming on, and we hope you'll come back again soon.
Thanks a lot, Liz. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and don't forget to join us again next week. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran, and we'll see you next week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast.